No, it's okay.
Yeah, no, we teach them all the different religious things. And, you know, we celebrate Christmas not as a religion, but you know, as a time to exchange gifts, and you know, we put a Christmas tree. But you know, my kids sing Hanukkah songs, and you know, growing up in New York, you know, we had everybody celebrated Jewish holidays. Well, when the public schools were off, and some of the Jewish holidays, so you know, they really grew up understanding, you know, the Jewish practices in New York, and you know, continue to you know, observe those things, not religiously, not as a religion, but as you know, as fun things.
As cultural.
Yeah, as a culture. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know, if they want to choose religion later, they can do so, but you know, we don't force them. I find it kind of a waste of time to be concerned about religion. So
yeah. And does that include kind of practicing any kind of spiritual belief in a god or gods, in a monotheism or a
Yeah, I went through a lot of changes, I guess, in the way I view about those things. That's why I was a philosophy major, so I thought about a lot of those things before. You know, I guess my feeling now is probably, if anything, is closer to the Buddhist way of looking at the world than anything else, because it's more realistic, you know, that I don't understand this thing about the sin, you know, all this stuff, and the guilt that the Western religions always sort of use as a kind of basis for everything.
Yeah.
Whereas Buddhism, it's suffering. There is suffering in the world. That's real. You see it all around the world. It's very simple. There's suffering in the world. There's something you have to do about it. The only part I don't agree with, the Buddhist way, I'm putting it very simplistically, is that, you know, there is suffering, so you have to behave and act in a certain way to overcome the suffering. So it's more, then it becomes kind of more focused towards the inner self, whereas I like the American sort of, not the religious view, but the American sort of practical views of the world, whereas if there is suffering, then you do something about it. So the philosophical basis may be Buddhism, but the action to take is more American.
Yeah.
So, and that's the way I think I view the world. And I think every individual has both a goodness, and that just has to be brought out. And you know, I think if you do that, then you don't need a religion. You know, I think every individual human being has a potential. As I think, if you're going to talk about good God, then God is already inside every individual. You just have to bring it out, and the struggle is to bring that out.
Mm.
And that's what the whole process is about.
And do you believe in reincarnation?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, thought about these things in a while. Any other parts of the childhood, or
just a big question, and I think it's, you know, it comes from being where we are at this time and place, and that is, you know, how do you identify yourself? And I'm sure I'd like, you know, you to discuss how you discuss identity, cultural identity, with your children too, because we live in a state that it's being discussed. We can't even write a K-12 social studies textbook that is agreeable to all, and what it is to be a minority, or what it is to be other, or even American, what it is to be American, if there is such a thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, how with your multicultural experiences, to use too worn of a phrase, how do you identify yourself in terms of who you are? Is there some kind of hyphenated term that you use? And how do you try and attempt to bring to your children the same kind of issue, being that your wife, they also come from a Jewish, which is culturally and religiously an identity, and Catholicism, which one can argue is culturally and religiously an identity.
No, it's you know, something I struggled, I guess, as I was growing up, because you know, in these all these forms, you always have to fill out, and they force you to fill out one of the boxes, you know. And so I usually fill out black, you know, African American as a box. So, but you know, as I grew older, I thought that was kind of not quite correct. You know, I know there's an issue right now that's more you know, there's mixed kids, you know, come up and become adults, and there's even a discussion about having another category in the census, you know, reports, I guess, for the next census, that, you know, being able to check a multi-ethnic category. And I think that's good, that at least these discussions are coming up now, because I think I do believe in a separate identity called multi-ethnic. You know, just a lot of us around now, and that should be a distinct category. You know, Tiger Woods was, I think, a very good example. I mean, I think he sort of popularized this, you know, being half Asian, also Thai, and half African-American. And you need sort of people like that to sort of bring this to attention. Because otherwise, you sort of put into a category that you're really not. I remember when I started college, you know, this was in 1968, you know, with all the these issues coming up with the black, you know, power movement, and you know, having dormitories, you know, specifically for the Hispanics and blacks and Asians, and you know, this is what was going on. And you know, I would be invited to a black student union, and but when they looked at me, they sort of wondered what I was, and I wasn't very comfortable with everybody. You know, and of course, there were all, you know, always people who, you know, completely accepted me as African American, but there were others who, you know, didn't quite accept me as a true, genuine African American. So, you know, I felt uncomfortable. When I do, I go to the Asian side, it's the same thing. You know, there are, since I spoke fluent Japanese, you know, there are a lot of the Japanese sort of accepted me, you know, as one of their own. But you know, there were others who, you know, I didn't quite fit. So, so with my kids, you can see the pictures. I mean, they could look like anybody.
I was gonna say they look like kids to me.
Yeah. So, I think they're much more aware of this than I am, and all their friends are mixed, and it, to them, it doesn't seem to be an issue. At least in Berkeley, you know, we go to Nebraska or, you know, other places. You know, this might become an issue for them. We've always grown up in places where, you know, New York City too, the same thing. I mean, there's class. My, you know, oldest son Nicholas's class was just, they're kids from all over the world. You know, they're probably more internationally. It was a public school, but it was more internationally represented than here.
Okay.
So, you know, it was, for them, it doesn't seem to be a big issue. I think it's good. I think they'll consider themselves multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and multi-ethnic. But I think, you know, when we were growing up, when I was growing up, there were other kids like me too. I mean, you know, I have friends who were mixed, and you know, many of them, if one of the parents was African American, they would choose the African American site, being in the U.S. So. But you know, I grew up with my mother, so if anything, emotionally, I identified more as Japanese nice. Than anything else. Yeah. So. But I think for political reasons, being here. I usually put myself as African American. I think I'm considered African American here in the School of Public Health, so officially.
And so. Why is that, do you think?
Because I think I had to fill out some forms, and,
right.
and it also helps them with their quotas.
Right.
They
yeah.
can say they have an African American faculty member, right?
Yeah.
But they usually, I always do this as a joke, but by having me, they satisfy both quotas. Yeah, Asian and there with one person.
Yeah. So
I was always the only one of such, any of the residency of the Pew scholars.
Well, we can bring it up now because you've mentioned this big again. I think as a matter of circumstances at the time that we're living in. Is affirmative action in Prop 209 here in the state of California that's moving throughout mm-hmm. the U.S. and token mm-hmm. Minorities on faculties mm-hmm. is clearly an issue for the University of California
mm-hmm.
and I can say I was a biology major mm-hmm. at UC Irvine and I had one in all of my physics, mm-hmm. chemistry and biology mm-hmm. classes I had one African American
mm-hmm.
professor
mm-hmm.
And I've never seen, I've never interviewed an mm-hmm. African American Pew scholar.
Mm-hmm. There are.
Yeah. There aren't many of them.
There aren't many. So yeah, there are. Yeah.
How do you? Well, I guess to bring start off mm-hmm. this big discussion, how do you feel about these issues of affirmative action and being kind of the person who fills two categories, fills two boxes mm-hmm. at the one time?
Well, for certainly programs like Pew Scholar, there shouldn't be any sort of preferential type treatment. I think it should be based on science and work. And, but at the same time, I don't think my feeling is that affirmative action should be done away with. I think everybody has to be consistent. If they're going to do away with affirmative action, they should do it with all forms of affirmative action, including those that traditionally exists for the ones with numerals after their name, right? If you happen to be John Smith III, white, with a GPA of 3.7, and if you happen to be John Smith, with a also white. And GPA of 3.7, who's more likely to get into Harvard or Yale or Princeton?
Mm-hmm.
There's always that affirmative action that's always existed and they'll continue to exist. And if they're going to insist on doing away with that, affirmative action for the minorities, they should do away with that sort of thing too. You can't have both. And I think affirmative action is needed to make sure that those things don't happen, that those preferential treatment for the so-called privileged. Is not maintained.
Mm.
You use the word privilege. It's another word for affirmative action for a group of people who can do those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think affirmative action is necessary. Mm-hmm. But for certain types of activities, I think. You can't sacrifice quality. And I think in the long run, I think it would do harm by insisting on reducing quality by. Certain types of preferential treatment, I think. So, I think politically, you know, I think it's important to maintain affirmative action, but it can be done in a way that doesn't sacrifice quality too. So. You know, when I started college, affirmative action was just beginning to take place. Mm-hmm. So there was always an issue, you know, if you're a minority person on the campus, you know, like Stanford, I was at Stanford, you know, are you there because you came in through the affirmative action program or, you know, because you really got there because of your own merit? And, you know, I was a valedictorian of my class. You know, I knew myself that I got in there, you know, without any special treatment. But you never know. So you always feel like you have to prove yourself. So, you know, in that way, it's not helpful. Mm. But I think politically, you know, I think it's necessary.
Do you still feel like you have to prove yourself?
No, I think what I've done, I think, speaks for itself. So right. I don't feel like I have to. Yeah. I feel like I have to prove myself as a scientist, you know, not because of my ethnic background, okay. but just as a scientist.
And why is it that there are so few, say, African Americans in science?
Clearly, you know, there's the racism is involved. I'm sure, and you know, it's not any sort of specific, I guess, sort of racism, but just sort of the way things are built into the whole education system, you know, in the U.S. And, it's a very complicated thing to say in an interview of this type, but anything I say would just be kind of a generalization of my own views. Science is hard right now, you know, for anybody to get into science. I mean, into academic research science. I mean, it's not just, if you look, you know, how many Americans, you know, really come into, you know, basic research in academia these days? You know, all of my fellows are foreigners.
Right.
And so the standards are different now as it used to be in the 50s and 60s. And so the playing field is a lot more difficult, tougher, and then people are expecting to see more minorities in this playing field that's a lot tougher than it used to be. And so it's not surprising that we don't see very many. When we don't even see, you know, white Americans coming into basic research. And so people always, you know, ask this question, and, you know, even the standards, I think, to be able to do these things are different from the way it was. It was a lot easier to do research back in probably, you know, in such as when the funding was more abundant, and it was during that time when the blacks were not provided with opportunities to get into those things. And then as time evolved, when funding opportunities became more difficult, the sort of social obstructions, I guess, got easier, I think, for the African Americans, but in the meantime, the standards have changed. So now they're asked to compete in the same way, with a much harder standard, with the, you know, with less preparation time in, you know, the past, because they just didn't have the opportunities to play the same game. And so I think that's, it's very complicated.
Right.
I think that's probably why we don't see as many. The ones who are in research now have had long tradition, you know, of being able to do research and foster other investigators to come into the field. And, you know, that kind of history doesn't exist for most African Americans. If you see any African Americans in the basic science, they've had tradition. They are the people whose parents may have been in the sciences, or involved in academic, you know, institutions of higher learning. You know, their kids become that. So there just weren't very many in the tradition, and you know, it takes a whole society and culture to, you know, produce good scientists. And there are, you know, other things I can say too, you know, like, but they're sort of cliché-ish, you know. There's a real cultural emphasis on you know, or lack of emphasis, I guess, in the sciences, and, you know, I think in many minority communities. I think even in the schools around here, you know, the sports is the big thing, and, you know, there's very little science being taught, which is a real concern. Mm. And this is Berkeley. So,
right.
So, I think a lot of kids grow up worshipping sports heroes and entertainers and not the scientists. You know, you don't need an African-American role model. You just need a scientist. My role models were, I mean, I don't know if I had any role models, but, you know, I mean, you know, I read biographies of, you know, people like Albert Einstein and, you know, other scientists, and, you know, growing up. It never occurred to me that, you know, there weren't any black scientists I could identify with, things like that. It just never occurred to me. You know, there are always African American heroes that, you know, you identify with, but not necessarily, you know, somebody in science. So,
do you have any African American heroes or role models?
I don't know. I would say we're role models. You know, they're someone that I think everybody, you know, you don't have to be African American to admire them, you know, people like Colin Powell and you know, growing up, you know, you hear about Ralph Bunche, you know, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and working
his building named after him.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are just many others who are not the traditional heroes, like, you know, Martin Luther King, I mean, of course. But, you know, sort of individual, you know, people that I know who have been role models. I don't know if you know Don Hopkins, who was in Chicago, University of Chicago, was a assistant director of CDC at one time. And, you know, he was involved in the smallpox eradication campaign and wrote a book that was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And, you know, he's one of my, you know, if anything, a true, you know, role model who did public health. And, you know, he's actually you know, influenced me in, you know, in many ways. And when I was at CDC, you know, he was my advisor. So, So, yeah, there are many others. You know, my father's friends. You know, encouraged me. You know. I can't think of any specific persons. Yeah, so I guess.
Okay. Well, we'll go on to more of these topics, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But why don't we pick up and talk a little bit more of how you got to be a scientist?
Okay.
This has been really interesting. And just to go back a little bit, is, you know, how well, or to put it clear in my mind. So you, up through high school, you were in school, in Japanese school?
No, I was,
schools in Japan?
No, I went to, through junior high in
junior
Japan.
High.
I finished eighth grade in Japan.
Okay.
And then we moved to Thailand.
Yeah, would that, eighth grade
Oh, you mean Japanese
like
school?
Yeah.
No, Japanese school, I was in Japanese school until fifth grade.
Fifth grade.
Right.
And then
I switched to an American school.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In Japan.
On base,
right.
Base. Yeah.
And
okay.
I was there until I was in the eighth grade.
Yeah. Okay.
And then we moved to Thailand, and I went to an international school in Bangkok.
Okay.
And so that was all high school, from 9th through 12th.
So, okay. And how was the education that you received? It seemed fairly discontinuous, going from the Japanese,
mm-hmm.
basically, system to an American military system.
Well, American military system is not military. It's really
It's
no different from, I think, American public
system,
school.
Right.
Yeah. The things I remember, you know, because I didn't speak much English, you know, I had difficulty, I think, with some of the things that required English.
Yeah.
But the math, you know, I thought was very, very easy, and you know, I was able to. You know, I didn't have any problems with math. It took me about a year before I spoke enough English to be able to do the other things. So what happened was I was put into a third grade when I went to an American school, so I could pick up the language, and I stayed in third grade for a year, and then I skipped fourth and fifth and went into the sixth to catch up once my English got better.
So in third grade, you were a little bit older.
I was older than the other kids.
In sixth grade, you were
back in the
right.
Okay. It was not all that different, I think. You know, in terms of the way things were done. I mean, I didn't like, well, at that time, they had these, you know, Americans, they had these, what do you call, prayer things. Which I didn't know. You know, you're supposed to do the, before the class.
Prayers in school.
At that time, they still had it.
And the national anthem.
Right, the national anthem. Yeah, they had the national anthem.
Oh, really?
And they had, what is that passage?
In the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah, Lord's Prayer.
Okay.
And I didn't know how to, I never learned it.
Mm.
So the kids, and I felt very uncomfortable, you know, at that time, having to do that. And I remember going home and, my father had a copy of the Bible, so I had to sort of flip through the pages to see where it was.
What was his attitude of this prayer in school?
No, we never talked about it.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
I never brought it up in the family, but eventually I learned it. And then, I guess after about a year, they didn't do it anymore. So.
Right, yeah.
So it was okay.
Yeah.
I certainly felt a lot more comfortable in American school, you know.
Really? Why was that?
Because there were a lot of kids like me.
Okay.
You know, who were mixed also. And, you know, the Americans and, whereas in, you know, in Japanese schools, I was the only one who looked like me. And so, you know, until you got to know the people, the kids, you know, the most difficult part was always the first day of school. Because I didn't know them, they didn't know me. But after about 2 weeks, and then I was like, you know, everybody else. Whereas in American school, I didn't have to go through that process.
Yeah. Okay. And when out on the playground or after
mm-hmm.
school, were you hanging out with and speaking Japanese?
In Japanese school?
Or in American
school? American
school?
No, I was hanging out and speaking English, after I got to know
yeah.
the, you know, Americans, American kids. Hanging out in English.
And And do you remember any particular teachers or that tried to identify an interest of yours, whether it be scientific mm-hmm. or even like writing or?
Yeah, there were several. I remember this is when I was in third grade, I think. We had an essay contest that we had to do after the summer. And it's in Japan, the school year begins in March. And so the summer is, you get like a month and a half, 2 months off. And so you actually have to do homework during the whole time.
Yeah, okay.
And when you come back, then you have to write about the summer and all these things and turn in your homework notebook. And so I wrote an essay and I won an award in the school, you know, sort of publication. And the teacher really insisted that I, you know, submit the essay to this thing. And so that's when I got interested in, you know, sort of writing. And when I was in college, I told myself the first thing I'm going to write ever that's going to be published will be in Japanese. And I was able to do that.
Oh, really?
So I have an essay in Japanese that appeared in a Japanese magazine.
And what was it about?
It was about my view about Japanese-ness. I don't have a copy here. Sort of about my experiences. You know, after college, I spent a year in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I lived there for a year. And so it was sort of about my view of you know, what I observed during that period. But I can't remember what I said. But anyways, then when I was also, I think, in maybe second grade, there was one teacher who would always read stories to us, you know, after class, the whole class. And she was one of my closest teachers. She would always invite me, you know, to her place afterwards. And this is when I was in the orphanage, and so it was a very special treatment. In the orphanage, we couldn't go to the local schools nearby, near the orphanage. They wouldn't accept the mixed kids. So we had to go all the way to Yokohama, 1 hour commute on the bus every day. And that's the only school that would... It's actually a famous school in sort of a foreign district in Yokohama, but it was a Japanese public school. So, you know, we're sort of accepted as different to begin with, so it wasn't as bad. But I remember this one teacher. I can't remember her name, but it was a very supportive person. But those in Japan. And then when I switched to an American school, there was one teacher, one junior, I think I was in seventh grade, Mr. Motvik. I still remember him. Mm-hmm. He was very, very influential in my getting interested in sciences. He was a geologist.
Yeah.
He would take us to these trips in Japan, you know, to the volcanoes and things. And we have these school overnight trips, and those are really, really, really fun. But I think my interest in science really didn't take off until I was in high school.
High school, okay.
In Bangkok. So.
Yeah. And did the Rileys express any kind of expectations of what they wanted their children to become? As, you know, adults, should they go to the university? Should they go to college? Should they
adopt
a profession?
No, certainly they expected that I go to college. My father went to, you know, college.
Okay.
Yeah. In Tennessee. My mother didn't, but certainly expected, yeah, the kids to go to college. So.
Did your mother work outside the home?
Not when I was growing up. She was, but not when I was growing up. Yeah, there, you know, I don't. We talked about a lot of things, as, you know, families do about what you want to be when you grow up. Probably talked about that more with my mother than my father.
And what did you tell her?
I wanted to be a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't know what kind, but I didn't know what a scientist was, I guess.
And how did they encourage that interest?
I remember my father, I had to do some sort of report, I think, science report one time. And so my father was one day very impressed that I had all these books that I was reading just to do the, you know, the reference books to do this science project. And I guess that's when he discovered that I was really interested in science. Mm-hmm. And then he started sort of doing things. I guess he didn't know until then. And so I remember, yeah, that distinctly. And after that, he would buy me books. And I remember getting a telescope once.
Yeah.
You know, as a present, and microscope. And so, yeah, it was shortly after that that I guess he started encouraging me to go.
You get chemistry kits.
I wanted one. I never got a chemistry set. No.
Yeah. Well, so did you go to your local pharmacy and get the chemicals yourself?
We used to do those mix things.
Did you blow anything up?
No, I don't think I did. You know, at that time you could mail order these rocket fuel propellants, so we used to get those, make little rockets, and shoot them up.
Did your dad help you with that, or was that with
you? No, it was with my friends, friends, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was actually when I was already in high school, in Bangkok, we did that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what did your father do in the military?
So my adopted father was actually in the civil service.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he was a contractor for the U.S. Air Force. He was in civil service, but would do procurement work. For the Air Force.
And what was his college education background?
So he went to business school in Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee, where he grew up. And so, and he says, he's always talked about that. He says if he didn't go to that college, he would have never gotten that job in Japan.
Okay, so he was always a civilian working in Japan, attached to an American.
Yeah, he went there as a civil service, person, employee.
Yeah.
So. Okay. He moved to Southern California, I guess, when he was in his 20s with my grandfather. And my father was a very entrepreneurial. I mean, he's owned a couple houses, in his 20s already. And his grandfather was also, he had 7 kids.
Wow.
And every one of them, did very well. And so my father was he was a real go-getter, I guess, even when he was young. And then he saw an advertisement in Norton Air Force Base in Southern California about this position, and he applied to it, and, he got it. And then he was sent to Japan eventually and stayed there.
So was he originally from Tennessee?
He was from Tennessee. He was born in Memphis, Tennessee.
I see. Right. Okay, and then moved to California.
California with the grandfather. They started a grocery store in Fontana.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
And,
that's right.
So I visited there. In college, I used to visit my grandfather all the time. So.
In Fontana?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's not exactly a happening place. But
no. Yeah, there wasn't much, but I got to know my grandfather.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And I have an aunt, uncle lives in Barstow.
Oh, yeah.
So I used to go there, college, for Christmases. Because my parents were in Thailand still.
Okay.
So, I guess when the Vietnam War was starting, he was debating whether to come back to the States or take another position in Bangkok. He decided to take the position in Bangkok. So that's when.
And why was that? What was the decision based on?
I think he still wanted to stay overseas.
Yeah.
It was probably also better for the kids to be in an educational system overseas than to come back to the States to go to school.
By this time, though, you had decided to go to college in the U.S.
Yeah, you know, it was an international school. So okay. It was about 80% Americans.
Yeah. Okay.
So all the kids came back to the States, you know, for school. Either they didn't go to school, or they, you know, if they came back, they all went to American colleges. So that was just the natural order of things in the high school. And so I didn't know where I wanted. I wanted to, you know, go to California because, you know, during the summers when we were in Thailand, we would always visit. We'd come back every 2 years here and visit relatives. So we always went to see my grandfather or my uncle in Barstow. So I knew California. California was the only place I knew.
Okay.
And California is also a very well-known state. You know, in Japan, it's like the state that everybody goes to, you know, even the Japanese. So I wanted to go somewhere in California. And so I applied to a bunch of schools in California. And Stanford gave me a scholarship. And so.
Yeah. Okay. And did your parents ask their kids how they felt about moving from Japan, where, you know, you just mastered English, and now you're having to move to Thailand, where you're going to have to learn to speak Thai?
No, we didn't have to speak Thai. It was, I sort of regretted that, you know, later, but kind of an isolated community of, you know, Americans, and, you know, English-speaking school, and so it was very little encounter with the Thais, although, you know, see, when I was in college, every summer I went back to Thailand.
Yeah.
That's when I actually started learning Thai.
Okay.
But when I was in high school, it was just American thing, so it was not not a thing to do, you know, to actually learn Thai.
Mm. And where did you live in Bangkok?
So we lived, it was about 5 miles from where the school was, but closer to where my father worked.
Yeah. And was that also like a little American?
Yeah, there were a lot of Americans in the area.
Yeah.
There were Thais too, but you know, there were, you know, these very wealthy Thai neighborhoods. And it was not a typical living residential area that we were in. It wasn't really until college that I really sort of, I think, really realized that I was in Thailand. It was strange.
Meaning
that I really got to know really, you know, good Thai friends, and got to, you know, learn the language and really understand Thailand. In fact, that's why I even decided to go to medical school eventually. Because I wanted to go back to Thailand. Okay. But certainly that wasn't the feeling that I had when I was still in high school.
Were you aware that this was a developing country?
Well, you could tell. I mean, that, you know, even the 4 years I was there, and every summers I visited, you know, it was just constant change. I remember staying in a hotel in this one road when we first got there as a family, and there were cows, water buffaloes going down the highway, whereas, you know, I mean, you just don't see that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, even 3 or 4 years after that, you know, you didn't see those things. So.
Yeah.
It was a great time to be there, I think. You know, from 64 to 68, you know, before Thailand got popular, and, you know, before AIDS and all those things. So, you know, I when I was in high school, I guess in Bangkok, you know, I had, you know, a group of friends. It was really funny. Last week, right before Christmas, I get an email from my best friend from high school that we'd lost touch for over 30 years. And so he's been trying to look for me. And there was a group of us called the Aardvarks, which was like a bunch of nerds. You know, there's about 5 of us.
Nerds?
Yeah.
Okay.
we call ourselves the Aardvarks. And we're all, you know, things like the science club and, you know, getting together. But, you know, we're all Americans. So after, you know, Bangkok, we all sort of scattered all over the world, I guess. And we just sort of lost contact. And so this guy, Andy Roman, contacted another guy, Vince Bennett, and then Vince Bennett contacted me, found me through another friend who is now in Bangkok, Kim. And we're still looking for the fifth one. But it was really interesting. And so everybody was sort of filling each other's gaps of memory from these moments. And it's all, both Andy and Vince thought I was going to be a physicist. They mentioned the email last week that they always thought I was going to end up in a university, you know, academic as a physicist. And I told them they were wrong. They were partly right about, you know, that I ended up being a scientist in a university. I'm a professor, but it was interesting how people perceived of you even back then. Yeah. I didn't know that that's the way they, you know, perceived of me. So it's interesting to have other people tell what they thought about you, I guess, back then.
Yeah.
But it was really neat. It was just, they were really close friends, and we just lost touch, and now suddenly we're contacting, we're trying to have a reunion.
Let me pop in a new tape.
Okay.